Before we get going, here's the bit where I remind you that nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets. You're about to listen to a special preview edition of the Grant Williams podcast featuring my very special guest, Mark J. Higgins, the author of a terrific new book called Investing in US Financial History. Mark takes us back to the days of Alexander Hamilton and then walks us forward to today. And it really is a tour de force and a fascinating historical look through the history of the United States. And anybody who's listened to my podcast over the years knows how important I think understanding financial history is. So I was delighted to get this chance to spend an hour talking with Mark. Every episode of the Grant Williams podcast, including the endgame, the super terrific happy hour, the narrative game, This Week in Doom, Shifts Happen, and Chaos Theory, is available to Copper and Silver Tier subscribers at my website, grant-williams.com. Copper Tier subscribers get access to all the podcasts, while members of the Silver Tier get both the podcasts and my monthly newsletter, Things That Make You Go, Hmm. So, if you enjoy what you hear on the show, and if you want more high-quality content like it, then please make your way over to grant-williams.com and join our exciting community today. And now, on with the show. Mark J. Higgins, welcome. What a great pleasure to see you and to have you join me on the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Grant. As we mentioned before the call, I've heard a few of your podcasts, and your appreciation for financial history definitely got me excited. So I'm excited to talk to you. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure is all mine, I promise you. As you're about to find out, as I say, you and I were chatting before we started recording. And anyone that's listened to me be a guest on anyone else's podcast knows that any time I'm asked, what's the best piece of advice you can give people, I always say, read financial history. You know, it's such an important thing to understand. And amazingly, once you start reading it, it's so fascinating. You know, how we got here and the twists and turns we've taken are so fascinating. And all the answers to the future are in there somewhere. You've got to do a bit of work, but until you read it and know what happened, it's tough to understand why. So the chance to read this book and the chance for everybody out there listening to buy and read a copy of this book is just too good a one to pass up. So before we actually talk about the book, I'd love to get you to talk about the journey to writing a book, because there's always a journey to writing a book like this. And I'd love to know what motivated you and inspired you to write the damn thing.
I've never written a book before, but throughout my entire career, I kind of had a knack for writing. So that wasn't too much of a stretch. But what happened was, it goes back to March 2020. I was consulting large institutional investors like pension funds and endowments and foundations. And when the COVID shock hit in March 2020, everybody was caught off guard, including myself. It seemed completely unprecedented. I think it was Ray Dalio who mentioned the importance of studying financial history. So I started reading books just to try to kind of make sense of what was happening. And the more I read, the more I found myself using financial history to help clients rather than just trying to make sense of the ton of data that's coming in every day. I couldn't believe that there really wasn't an accessible book on the full financial history of the United States. There are great books out there. I read 200 of them, but they're usually very narrow on a point in time. And that I couldn't have written this book without them, but there was no really comprehensive narrative on the full financial history of the United States. So I decided to take a shot at writing it. And 4 years later, the book it's called Investing in U.S. Financial History. It was just published about 2 weeks ago. And it really covers from 1790 until today.
It's a tremendous read. And as I said, I struggle to put the right amount of importance on this. I mean, look, it's my opinion only, but I've found every single piece of financial history that I've ever read has been useful. I've never read anything that wasn't useful either at the time or at some point in the future. And so to get this timeline was a real treat. And I want to actually start at the very beginning. And Lin-Manuel Miranda has done an awful lot of things for an awful lot of people, but calling attention to Alexander Hamilton to a whole world of people that knew nothing about him and now see him as kind of a rap icon is fantastic. But what he did back in the late 1700s was so important. So let's go back to that and frame the conversation with the before and after Hamilton, because I think it was such a key point.
There are a few people that can highlight it as legends. And once you investigate them, they may not be. Alexander Hamilton was incredible. And he was self-taught. And when in 1790, the United States was about 2 years old and our finances were a complete mess. We were, you know, effectively defaulting on all of the debt that were, they were states now, but the, that was issued to fight the war in the revolution. And Alexander Hamilton studied a lot of financial systems, including the Bank of England was what he modeled the first central bank in the United States off of. But he basically created a three-pronged program of one, consolidating all of the debt and backing it by the full faith and credit of the federal government. Two, establishing, and it was kind of, it wasn't exactly like a central bank today, but establishing the first central bank in the United States called the First Bank of the U.S. And then third, making sure that raising tariffs so that we could fund the debt. And that really put the United States on firm financial footing for the first time. And we have sustained that until today.
Yeah, it sounds so simple, right? To pool all the obligations and to get everybody to come together. But that was no mean task what he managed to accomplish, right? And remind me how old he was. He was in his 20s, right?
I don't know offhand how old he was, but either in late 20s or early 30s is incredible. He was just very, this is actually something that to emphasize, and it's something that I saw the more and more I researched financial history, some of the best investors and financial minds, almost universally, I can't really find an exception, are avid readers. And Alexander Hamilton was among them. He read every economic book and history book that he could get his hands on. Even during the war, when they were stationed at Valley Forge, they would see him reading books. And that's really what enabled him to do this. He didn't really have a formal education. He did have some, but it was mostly self-taught.
But he also had no Netflix and no TikTok as well, which is a huge advantage. So let's put into perspective just how important it was, this move to back the debt by the full faith and credit of a United States. Because if he hadn't done that, the picture would have been very, very different.
I talk about this a little in the book, but he had some experience in kind of the import-export business while he was in Nevis and St. Kitts, which is where he was born, and stabilizing the currency. And by enabling the government to issue, by improving the credit of the United States, enabling the government to issue debt at attractive terms was a fuel for industry. And the data's a little spotty back then, but you can see it. And I have some data in the book that shows that the economy started to grow. And this is really setting the stage for the United States to begin evolving from a frontier agricultural economy to an early stage industrial economy. And that was fundamental to that. I personally doubt the United States would have worked without it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And we will jump back and forth in this conversation, but I'm going to jump forward 230 odd years to today, because as you say, right, it was so important to be able to create a credit market and create faith in the credit of the United States. And it did help the country grow. And now we reach today where we're seeing what happens when you create something that's so beneficial at a certain stage of a country's economic development and can turn into a monster if allowed to grow unchecked. So it's a very incredibly broad question. You can take it in whichever direction you like, and we'll definitely jump back in at various points. But talk about that journey from creating a credit market that allowed the United States to grow and become the richest country in the history of mankind to today, where those same credit markets are probably the biggest problem facing the country.
Yeah. So the thing that struck me, I actually think it's probably the most important insight that came out of this book. And it's one that you don't see if you don't look back far enough. And the way I did the research for this book is I literally started in 1790 and worked my way as if I was living through U.S. history to the present. And the thing that became glaringly obvious is our perspective toward the use of the public credit changed after World War II. And if you go back to Hamilton, this is actually in his first report on the public credit to Congress. He strongly advocated for repairing the finances of the United States. And he believed in that the public credit was essential, especially during emergencies. So mostly foreign war at that point. But that after, it should be paid back. The United States did that for most of its history. We ran up the debt in the War of 1812, we paid it back. We ran up the debt in the Civil War, we paid it back. World War I, paid it back. And then after World War II, we actually did run some surpluses for roughly a decade, but we pretty much stopped paying it back. And the reason is because we were abnormally wealthy and we thought that would continue indefinitely. And the reason we were abnormally wealthy is because most of the world's industrial infrastructure was either impaired or destroyed. The United States was actually strengthened because we were building everything for our allies. And we had 70% of the world's gold. So gold was, you know, essentially money back then. And we projected that that would continue in indefinitely. And by the 1960s, our spending really was not sustainable. And the rest of the world started catching up. And we started running deficits in every year. It wasn't just when there was an emergency. Every year as a standard, we ran a deficit. And that has continued until today. And the challenge is most Americans weren't alive when the country was living within its means. You'd have to go all the way back to really the 1920s. I mean, we were running deficits in the Great Depression, and we don't know what it's like to live within our means. And that, to me, at least from a financial perspective, is really the existential challenge that the United States needs to deal with in the 21st century.
Well, and there's a couple of points there. First of all, obviously, the Bretton Woods system was a big tailwind for America being able to live beyond its means. Even though it was a quasi-gold standard, it allowed the United States to build up those deficits. And I think as you watch what's happened there, and we'll talk about the gold standard in a second, because again, I think that's a very misunderstood part of America's financial history. As we saw what happened post-World War II and with the Bretton Woods system, it became obvious that not only did the United States have the ability to run larger deficits, it almost had an obligation to the rest of the world to do so. You know, it wasn't all through choice necessarily.
It's the Triffin paradox. So if the dollar is the world's reserve currency and it's tied to gold, then the United States needs to run trade deficits so that central banks have enough dollars for their reserves. But as that continues, eventually the number of dollars is going to exceed the gold that is backing it. And someone's going to figure that out, and there's going to be a run on gold. And that's exactly what happened in 1971, the system broke.
Yeah, and you know, presaged by everybody's friends, the French.
They were the one taking advantage of it most, yes.
They were. But let's talk about the gold standard, though, because if you talk to people today about the U.S. being on the gold standard, and if you tell them...
The full conversation is available to subscribers to the copper and silver tiers of my website, grant-williams.com. Nothing we discussed should be considered as investment advice. This conversation is for informational and hopefully entertainment purposes only. So while we hope you find it both informative and entertaining, please do your own research or speak to a financial advisor before putting a dime of your money into these crazy markets.